When you say pass Hanukkah, you make me pass through Hanukkah,
Right, this is, you're here for me, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I wasn't sure. Okay. Okay, how many people are coming?
I think I heard 12 somewhere.
Okay, so we'll wait a few more minutes. Okay.
What class is this supposed to be for?
Didn't hear you. I didn't hear what you said.
What class is this supposed to be for?
Rabbi Schiller Jr. asked me to, he said it was like J internship, so that's what he told me.
Yeah. You have to get it. Did Shomi invite you?
No.
Sorry, I don't know if,
Well, we don't, I don't think we kick people out.
I was coming tomorrow.
I'm not. No, I don't think anyone's in there right now.
Did you get questions, Josh?
No way.
I don't have looking.
You texted in the laughter.
I wrote the
Laufer?
Yes.
And
I wrote the conference room for
him.
No, you wrote the Laufer. Oh, the conference room? So which one? I didn't hear one way or the other. Conference room?
Yeah, so.
Okay.
I was just bringing stuff in. I think we should do it in the conference room.
Okay. That's fine. Closer to me?
I'm bringing food for them. The other groups that you're in.
You got it. Okay.
So many things going on. I will.
Happy to have you.
These boys have the same name, Josh Bowen.
Same name, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they're both British.
Josh 1, Josh 2, or?
Double time.
Hope everyone's doing well, and for some reason, I'm not sure why, Rabbi Schiller asked me to talk about medical ethics. I hope that'll be of interest to people. Kind of out of, vis-a-vis me, it was kind of out of the blue, but I do talk about medical ethics quite a lot. So it's a topic that I'm personally interested in, and hopefully you'll find some interest in it. In particular, I want to talk about an issue that it's not so much in the news these days, but it has been in the news for a very long time, and that is the issue of the halachic permissibility of stem cell research, and what would be the questions that one would ask and the like. And stem cell technology is no longer as new as it was. It's now around 15 years old, and it has tremendous, tremendous potential. Again, to be sure that everybody understands what are stem cells, you have to understand the following concept. Cells are generally specialized. We have skin cells, and we have liver cells, and we have kidney cells, and we have brain cells, and spinal tissue cells. But one of the amazing things about not just the human body, but really any living cell, is that the entire genetic code of the organism is actually in the cell. But in the course of getting differentiated, everything that it's not going to become simply gets shut off. So, for example, in your skin cell is the DNA encoding for liver and kidney and spinal tissue and eye. But since it becomes a skin cell, everything else shut off. This is called cell differentiation or cell expression. A lot of different words. And this is still...
Guys, you can do this later, okay? We're not eating now.
Okay. And this is still one of the great, I won't call it a secret, but still science is still grappling to understand the precise mechanism of cell differentiation. In fact, cloning is essentially trying to turn the clock back. For example, in cloning, you take a somatic cell, like a skin cell, and you put it in an egg from which you stripped away the nucleus. And then that skin cell, as it were, kind of, I guess we don't use the word fertilization, but whatever it is, begins a process of cell division in which you can get a whole organism that way. So from a single skin cell combined with the egg, but the egg is not a genetic contributor because you took away the nucleus. So the only genetic material is that skin cell. You're reconstructing the entire organism. You're turning the clock back on a differentiated cell, which is pretty amazing. And the reason that can happen is because everything is in there. It's quite amazing. It really ties into mystical ideas that in every part there is the whole. That guy, right? Every single part contains the whole of everything. It's like infinite holograms, in which this piece contains all of that piece, and you keep on going and going and going. But that's kind of cloning. That's not directly what I'm going to talk about, although maybe we'll hit that as well. So initially, if you take, let's say, plain vanilla reproduction, so what you simply have, let's say, egg and sperm, right? Not cloning or anything fancy, egg, sperm, etc. So you get a fertilized embryo. Initially, it's called a blastocyst, and it keeps on dividing. But initially, when it divides for 10 to 14 days, you don't really have, you know, skin cells, or in other words, it just becomes, it's generic cells. If I may quote the very, very famous, renowned folk singer Mary Travers of Peter, Paul, and Mary, again, listening to the music is a question of kolisha, but she did die of cancer a few years ago, and she was one of the first people who were using stem cell therapy. And for a while, it helped her go into remission. But she said the best definition of stem cells that I ever heard. She was giving a talk, and she said, stem cells are cells that haven't decided what they want to be when they grow up. And that's exactly right. A stem cell hasn't taken a position yet. So for around 14 days, you have these cells, but they haven't become anything in particular. They have infinite potential. They're called pluripotent. They're not called omnipotent, because that's only God, but pluripotent means they can become all sorts of things. And then eventually, the embryo begins differentiation. I'm not using all of the technical vocabulary, you know, skin, and you know, the neural tube first, and then you know, the different systems, and the like. So it was discovered around 15 or 20 years ago that if you harvest those stem cells that have not become differentiated, they're just generic cells, you can, number one, reproduce them indefinitely. You can create lines of these cells in a petri dish. And then through various stimulants, you can coax them to become whatever type of cell you want. You can make them into spinal tissue, heart valve tissue, because they have all of the DNA encoding. Now, this is quite an amazing thing. Now, this idea of stem cells that can become anything, the most common source are the embryos in their very early stage of embryonic development. Those are called embryonic stem cells. However, there are stem cells in other parts of the organism. For example, in bone marrow, there is stem cells. In placentas after birth, or the umbilical cord, there are stem cells. So sometimes there are adult stem cells as well. Now, most of the controversy, most of the debate, when people say stem cell research and all of those different complications, they're usually talking about embryonic stem cells for the reason that I will tell you. But in point of fact, many, many doctors feel that adult stem cells are actually very, very good. I once heard a talk by a cardiologist, a very prominent cardiologist, in which the way he treats patients who have defective heart valves is he literally takes an injection, it's an amazing thing, an injection of stem cells, adult stem cells from bone marrow and the like, injects it into the heart, and somehow, you know, this is really God's, the miracles of God's creation, somehow these stem cells sense what they're supposed to become because they're in proximity to the heart tissue, and they become heart valve replacements. And that's kind of, even without surgery, I mean, it's an, you know, it's an injection, it involves, you know, it's more complicated than I'm describing it, but this is a non-surgical way to regenerate heart valve tissue through stem cells. And he uses adult stem cells. Okay, but whether we use embryonic stem cells or adult stem cells, the way they work is the same. They eventually can become differentiated based on what is needed. So this is tremendous. This can work for heart. This has and does work for heart valve tissue. It eventually might work for spinal cord tissue to help Parkinson's patients and the like. And eventually, technology is not there yet, eventually you might be able to create whole organs from stem cells, that from stem cells we could create hearts. Now you know that organ transplantation itself is a very, very controversial halachic area. But putting aside the halacha of that for a moment, because I can give you a whole other shir on that, the major societal problem in organ donations, the societal problem, is a shortage of organs. You need a donor to get an organ. And most people, number one, even non-Jews, nothing to do with religion, are not organ donors. And number two, even if you have an organ donor, the body rejects the foreign tissue, so that's a whole complication. But imagine this. With stem cells, we could use the donor, not the donor, the patient, the victim, the one who needs the transplant. We could use his own stem cells to create a whole heart. And if that's so, we give him back his own heart. The body will not reject it because that's genetically his heart. Right? Amazing thing. And this would obviate, in theory, this could obviate the whole problem of donor shortages. And it would also eliminate the halachic problem, because halacha has a very big problem with taking organs from donors, not because you're taking from the dead, that you would be allowed to do to save a life, but because according to halacha, as long as again, organs are typically removed from people who are called brain dead, meaning their heart is actually beating, because otherwise the heart would atrophy, but there's no brain function, and as a result the heart is being kept alive only by ventilation, the oxygen. Now, legally, that person is dead, so they take the heart. Halachically, many opinions, not all, but many opinions do maintain that that person is alive. So when you're taking a heart from that donor, you are murdering that donor, and you wouldn't be allowed to do that. That is a major, major halachic problem with organ transplants. It is not the problem that most people think. Most people point to the idea, well, Judaism says you're not allowed to do autopsies, which is true. You're not allowed to do cremations, which is true. You're not allowed to dissect bodies, which is true. And people will often say, and that's why you can't do organ donation. Bad. That's false. Because even though you do have all of those prohibitions can be violated to save a life. But murder cannot be violated to save a life. And if, according to halacha, brain dead people whose heart is still beating, because if you wait until the heart stops beating, the heart is not suitable for transplantation. So brain dead people whose heart is still beating are alive, you're dealing with a whole other different problem. You're dealing with a murder problem. You're not dealing with a, you know, autopsy or dissection or, you know, cremation. You're not dealing with how we treat dead bodies. You're dealing with, you know, killing somebody alive. So be it as it may, what is so amazing is that if stem cell retrieval could ever be used to create organ systems, and we're very far from that, we're not there yet, this would not only solve the societal problem of shortages and rejection, it would also solve the halachic problem of murder from these donors. It's an amazing thing. Okay. So now, what are the problems? What are the halachic downsides? Now again, many researchers don't really ask Rabbi Shilas. Many of them are non-Jews. They don't follow halacha and the like. But theoretically, we have to know how Judaism would deal with this technology. And again, some of you might go into biomedical research, so you yourself would have to know how Judaism deals with this problem. So the basic issue is this. The basic issue is that just like the old saying, you can't make an omelet without breaking a couple eggs, so too, you cannot get embryonic stem cells without having an embryo that is terminated in the process of stem cell retrieval. Right? In other words, how are stem cells retrieved on the embryonic way? We have, let's say, an egg and a sperm producing an embryo. It divides. And at some point, now again, this is not like killing a baby, but when they harvest stem cells, you're dealing with something that is visible, but it's the size of a thick dot. Take your pen, make a thick dot. That's what we're talking about. But nevertheless, it is a live embryo. And the stem cells are harvested, and then they're replicated, etc., creating stem cells that can then be coaxed into specialized tissue functions and the like. So the big problem is stem cell retrieval early term abortion? Because you have an embryo that is being destroyed. Well, is that abortion? Now, the Catholic Church, in point of fact, the Catholic Church, which does regard, in fact, Catholic Church is stricter than even halacha is on abortion. They regard abortion as murder, and consistent with their very, very strict view, they say the retrieval of embryonic stem cells is murder because you are killing that dot, which they say is already a human life, because life begins, according to that teaching, I'll get to halacha, of course, life begins at conception. And therefore, the Catholic Church says there's no way embryonic stem cell retrieval can ever be permitted. It is an act of murder. Now, I don't want to spend a lot of time criticizing the Catholic Church position, but I do want to point to a certain anomaly in their position that one needs to be carefully considered. Keep in mind, how do we get embryonic stem cells? I mean, we don't just, you know, go to people, I mean, and, you know, take out the embryos. These are donated embryos, meaning to say, generally, the normal source for embryonic stem cell retrieval are a husband and wife that are going through a fertility treatment, and they're going through an in vitro fertilization, and many eggs have been taken from the woman, and they've been fertilized, and more fertilizations have taken place than can be safely or desired to be implanted. So an example might be, I'll give you just a concrete example, take an in vitro fertilization where 20 eggs were taken, because they want to maximize the chances. 20 eggs are taken from the woman. So if one or two are fertilized, which is often the case, by the way, it's often the case that you need 20 just to get one or two fertilized, so she'll do one or two. But what if 7 or 8 are fertilized? Or even 10? Right? What do you do? So the couple has a number of options. And when you go to a fertility clinic, the hospital will give you options. One option is fertilized embryos can actually be frozen for use in a later reproductive cycle. So that would mean that basically twins that might have been fertilized at the same time, might be 3 years apart or 5 years apart or whatever. That's one possibility. A second possibility, which halachically is very problematical. The freezing one is actually a very good halachic possibility. But the next possibility is donation to another infertile couple. Well, that sounds very humane and it sounds nice, but halacha has tremendous, tremendous problems with it, because essentially, who is the mother, who is the father? Well, the father, we know, the father is the sperm, but in terms of the mother, who is the mother, where the egg comes from one woman and the gestation is the other, and if one is Jewish and one is not Jewish, you're not going to know, who is the kid, Jewish or not Jewish. So generally speaking, although it sounds like a very generous gesture, I mean, it is a generous gesture, but halacha would not be in favor of donating embryos. To the same degree, halacha is not in favor of surrogacy or the like, any type of splitting of the motherhood. But the third choice that you'll be given is donating the embryo for biomedical research, such as stem cell retrieval. Now, let's say you're a good Catholic, and here's the problem. If you're a good Catholic, and you know that the Catholic Church does not allow retrieval of stem cells, you're going to say, can't do it. On the other hand, you're not going to get implantation either. So what often happens with these embryos is not that because we're not doing stem cell research, we're going to have a baby. What happens is they get flushed down the toilet, meaning to say, they're going to get destroyed anyway, either actively or passively. So one could question, if something is going to get destroyed anyway, isn't it better that we use it in a positive way? No, maybe not. Maybe one would argue, if something is sinful, we should just treat it as sinful. You shouldn't give it a sign of heksher by using it for something good, right? That's an interesting question. Do you take evil, when things are considered evil, is it that you try to salvage something good out of them? Or do you say, no, evil should be evil, and we shouldn't try to salvage something good out of it, because then people think it's good. Let me give you an example from Jewish tradition that talks about that. During World War II, the Nazis performed medical experimentation on Jews in concentration camps. And because they did whatever they wanted to do to Jews, so they performed all sorts of experiments that would be totally, totally immoral, unethical, illegal today. So, for example, they did experiments on hypothermia. They would immerse the genitals of people into ice-cold water and see, how many minutes it took for either death to occur or something else. Now, what's interesting is they wanted to give themselves the pretense. They wanted to legitimate their brutality and their sadism with a patina of scientific respectability. So they actually had the chutzpah, so to speak, of writing up the results of these experiments in medical journals. So there'll be an article entitled Human Response to Extreme Hypothermia, a study done on, 150, inmates or whatever, people in, I'm sure they didn't even use concentration camp, they had some euphemism for that. Now, what's interesting is that these types of experiments, could never be done today, and rightfully so. So in the 1970s, some researchers got a hold of these old journals, and they wanted to use the findings of these journal studies to extrapolate what happens to human beings under extreme conditions. So many Holocaust survivors were very, very appalled, because they said, you're taking Hitler's experiments on, our grandparents, and you're now going to kind of use it as if to say Hitler did something or the Nazis did something good with all of this. And they actually took the position that because this is evil, we throw it away, we reject it, we don't get anything out of it, because that would be somehow legitimating this awful, awful crime against the Jewish people and really crime against humanity. However, interestingly enough, contrary to what you might think, when the question was submitted to halachic authorities, they took a different view. They understood the emotional aspect of it, but they basically said, tragedies are tragedies, and evil is evil, and we are certainly not giving a stamp of approval. But if there's something positive you can get from even the evil that human beings commit, not only is there nothing wrong, but it's even considered to be proper to try to get something good. So I'm just going back to the Catholic Church. So according to that, this would be the opposite of the Church's approach, that if the embryo is going to be destroyed anyway, then the harvesting should not be considered evil, because you're simply, the sin is going to happen, and you're simply using the sin to good effect. But okay. But when we go to the Jewish approach, we have to answer the basic question: is it a sin to destroy an embryo to harvest stem cell research? So in order to understand this, we first have to have a little bit of a background, not a lot, on the Jewish law of abortion generally. Let's talk about a real abortion. The woman is 4 months pregnant, right? Abortion. So here you have to know the following. The Jewish law of abortion is actually much more complicated than you might assume. You know, in the typical abortion debates, where we have pro-lifers who say, you know, life begins at conception. Although, you know the joke about pro-lifers, because pro-lifers tend to be very, very conservative. And conservative politicians don't like government programs that help mothers with children. So they say the motto of a pro-life movement is, life begins at conception, but it ends at birth. Meaning, once the kid is born, you know, we only care about the fetus, we don't care about the kid. But okay. But be it as it may. But the pro-lifer shita view is that life begins at conception, and therefore abortion is murder. The pro-choice view is there is no life until birth, etc. Now, Jewish law doesn't quite look at it that way. See, Jewish law does not have the either-or approach. The way Jewish law works is, human life does not begin until birth. Abortion is not a capital crime. Abortion is not murder in the eyes of halacha. But the fetus has life potential. It has the potentiality of life. And therefore, its future potential, or the, actually it's the present potential of what it will become in the future, must be respected and must be guarded. Not so much because of what it is, but because of what it would become. So it's a different halachic theory. The halachic theory is not the same as pro-life. De facto, we are much closer to pro-life than pro-choice. Absolutely. Judaism is against abortion. I'll flesh it out a little bit. So please don't misunderstand me. Judaism prohibits abortion on demand. It is a great, great sin. So factually, we are aligned with the philosophy of pro-life, but not for the same analytical underpinning. The analytical underpinning of the Catholic Church is life begins upon conception. According to Jewish law, that is actually not true. Life begins at birth, but conception creates a potentiality that must be respected. Now, this is not just splitting hairs. This actually explains why abortion is not a capital crime. If I kill a born person, that is murder. If I kill a fetus, that is a sin, but it is not murder. So again, at a time when in the temple we would administer the death penalty for these crimes, abortion would not be murder, but it would be murder to kill a human being. Now, it gets a little complicated, because I am describing the law of the Torah that applies to Jews. Paradoxically, under the 7 laws of Noah that applies to Gentiles, abortion is a capital crime. Now, that kind of makes you scratch your head. Well, is a fetus a person or not? I mean, you can't say, well, if a goy kills him, we treat a fetus like a person. And if a Jew, because it doesn't, we don't care who the fetus is, we're talking about the one who performs the abortion. How can the fetus be a person if a non-Jew aborts him, but the fetus is not a person if a Jew aborts him? That's not, you know, that doesn't make sense. He's either a person or not a person. But essentially, it would seem to be that the fact that under the Noahide code there is a death penalty, it does not automatically equate it to murder. It might just, because all of the Noahide violations have death penalties. Theft under the Noahide law is a death penalty. So therefore, death penalty does not equate to murder. So it doesn't necessarily change the theory. Okay, but to go back to the basic halacha, again, I can go over all sorts of sources here, but I just want you to get the bottom line, because abortion is really just our segue to stem cell research. So abortion under Jewish law is generally forbidden. It is not a capital crime. It is not equivalent to murder. But it is true that abortion is only permitted if the mother's life is in danger. If the mother might, we don't say for sure she will, but if she might die, if she brings the child to birth, we are permitted, it is a mitzvah even, to abort the child. Now, interestingly enough, if the mother herself chooses, she would rather take the risk and die, she is given the right to make that choice as well. In other words, she could choose to risk her life to bring the child to fruition, but if she doesn't make that choice, abortion is permitted, b'makom pikuach nefesh. Now, the thing to know about that is, pikuach nefesh is a very slippery concept. The narrowest case, of course, is her medical condition is such that whatever it might be, giving birth to a child might rupture her aorta, right? So that's the simplest case of pikuach nefesh. But you have to understand, halacha recognizes that psychological trauma can also be life-threatening, either in the sense of suicidal or nervous breakdown. Let me give you an example. Let's take the controversial issue of rape and incest. So you'll often hear pro-life people say the following statement: I'm against abortion, except in the cases of rape and incest. Now, that is really incoherent in some ways. Because if you take the position that life begins upon conception, the Catholic Church position, the pro-life position, and abortion is murder, well, can I murder a child that was born from rape and incest? I hope not, and I think not. So why are you allowing abortion in the case of rape or incest? It's not the kid's fault. Now, how would Judaism approach the rape or incest? So here is how Judaism would approach it. It's not such an easy inquiry. Judaism does not have a rape or incest exception. Abortion is forbidden unless the mother's life is in danger. That's it. But Judaism recognizes that the traumatic events that cause the pregnancy may be such that having to bring the child into the world may or may not, may, not yet will, but may be life-threatening depending on the mother's overall psychiatric orientation. So, as a result, there will be some cases, underline some cases, of rape or incest in which an abortion may be halachically justified because of pikuach nefesh. There will be many other cases where it will not be. Meaning we don't have a rape or incest exception. We have a pikuach nefesh exception. But we recognize rape or incest may be one of those circumstances that is life-threatening. But obviously, we have to explore the options. It may be traumatic to raise the child, but perhaps giving up the child for adoption, you know, doesn't have that same trauma. It's a very funny thing. It's also illogical. I mean, I understand it emotionally a little bit. Sometimes when women feel they have to have an abortion because of the trauma, whatever it is, so when it is suggested to them to give up the child for adoption, they say, I could never put up my child for adoption. Okay, so what's the alternative that you're contemplating? You know, I mean, whatever it is, giving up a child for adoption is better than terminating the child. This way the child has a chance for life. And indeed, one has to recognize that adoption is often a very, very supreme act of love. It actually is that a parent who feels that for whatever reason they cannot take care of their child wants to give the child. In other words, instead of looking at putting up a child for adoption as a rejection of the child, it can often be a very, very loving gesture in different ways. But okay, putting that aside. So we start off with the basic construct that abortion is prohibited unless it's necessary to save the mother's life, at least potentially. Okay, so now let's apply all of that to the stem cell retrieval and see where this gets us. Well, it is true that when we retrieve stem cells, there's already been conception. So the question is, do the abortion prohibitions kick in at that early stage? When do the abortion restrictions kick in? So I'm going to mention to you three different halachic concepts that can be used to perhaps create exceptions to the abortion law, and therefore would allow the harvesting of embryonic stem cells. Rule number one is that some take the position that any abortion is permitted if it is within 40 days of the pregnancy. And obviously stem cell retrieval is within 14 days. By the way, freezing doesn't count. Freezing, in other words, we're looking at embryonic development, not, I mean, if something was frozen for a year, but it was frozen at the 14-day stage, it is 14 days even after that time passed. Now, if you go with the 40 days, and I'll explain the basis of that, then stem cell retrieval would be fine. Now, where do these rabbis get the 40 days? They get the 40 days from a Talmudic statement that says that the first 40 days after conception, the embryo is mere water. That is actually the language. Mayim ba'alma. Mere water. It doesn't have the status of human life. It is mere water. And therefore, they want to say you could abort. Now, here's a very important rule that you must remember. Never take quotations out of context. If somebody quotes you a statement, whether it's the Talmud or the New York Times, lahavdil, don't just look at the words. Go back and say, what was the Talmud talking about? You need to know. The Talmud statement that within 40 days the fetus is mere water is not talking about abortion at all. Abortion was not the subject of that discussion. The discussion was a totally different discussion. There is a law in Leviticus that a woman after childbirth, whether it's a live birth or a miscarriage, must bring a sacrifice in the temple. If she had a boy, she brings it on the 41st day after the miscarriage or the birth. If it's a girl, she brings it the 81st day. And if it's indeterminate, she waits the longer period because she doesn't know. Now, a little digression. Why would a woman after childbirth have to bring a sacrifice? So the answer that 9 out of 10 of us would say is, well, it's a Thanksgiving offering. Nope, it's a sin offering. What's she bringing a sin offering for? So the Talmud says, quite practically, because a woman in the pains of labor might have taken an oath that she will never do this again. And that's a sin, so she has to bring a sin offering. Okay. Also, one might connect it that the pain of childbirth comes from the sin of Eve, right? So in a sense, it says, you're going through this because of that sin, bring a sacrifice, because you're kind of continuing that tradition. Okay, so it is in that context that the Talmud says, if a woman has such an early miscarriage, I mean, she wouldn't even see it as a miscarriage, it would just be a discharge of blood, but if there was such an early miscarriage that it's within 40 days of conception, it doesn't count. Now, again, what you need to see is the passage contextually is not talking about abortion. It is talking about what is a sufficient birth for a sacrifice and what is not. Some rabbis have taken the position, okay, granted the Talmud is talking about sacrifice, but if it says it's like mere water, then that should apply to abortion too. However, I want to point out that the greatest rabbis have not given this heter. Rav Moshe Feinstein rejects the heter of pre-40-day abortion. And if you think about it, the logic is quite compelling. Because if, as I told you, the halachic basis of abortion is not murder, but it's frustration of potential, all the Gemara is doing with the pre-40 days is negating existing personhood. It's saying it's not a person. That's fine. But abortion is not based on killing a person. It is based on frustrating a potential person. Just because something is not a person doesn't mean it's not a potential. And therefore, according to this psak, abortion even pre-40 days is going to be forbidden. So that wouldn't be a basis for the stem cell. Now, if you get into that debate, let me point out, this is also relevant regarding the morning after pill. contraception is very different than abortion. Contraception is also something one doesn't do normally because of the mitzvah of procreation, but it doesn't have the sin of abortion because you're not terminating an embryo. But the morning after pill, which is a type of medication or a type of pill that a person could take, a woman could take after she was impregnated, that is potentially an early abortion, but it's obviously within 40 days. So some opinions will permit the morning after pill, and some opinions will say the morning after pill is abortion. Again, it's a little more subtle because it prevents implantation, which might make it a little better, but at least you'll get into that question. Yeah.
Yeah, so when it comes to the morning after pill or the act of abortion, the decision for abortion, does the sin equal as heavily on the woman as it does the man? The decision of abortion, because it's truly affecting her physically, you may say spiritually as well.
Yeah.
But the man enacted it too, so if his decision is also weighed in abortion or getting the morning after pill,
yeah,
it is not...
Well, I think we would say that the woman's desires are going to be more powerful here because she is the most intimately affected, and of course, whether or not her life is in danger has to be based in large part about how she feels, not about how the husband feels. But the sin will be on both parties. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
If the whole issue with abortion, according to Judaism, has to do with frustrating the potential,
yeah,
then I don't see how we'd even think of a problem with stem cells, because stem cells, the potentiality of what it could be is saving a life. Wouldn't that essentially be the same thing?
Well, yes, but the question would be, lives are not interchangeable, meaning you normally can't terminate this one in order to save that
one.
We're
not terminating anyone, we're talking about a
potential. Potential, okay, I understand. So the question, that's very excellent. In fact, that's going to be the next point I'm going to raise. The issue becomes, do you look at potential in a generic way, or do you look at potential vis-a-vis the particular, life that would be generated from this reproductive process. But I'll get to what you're saying is really my next point.
Quick question.
Yeah.
40 days is based on the Gemara?
Yeah, absolutely. It's in the Gemara, yeah.
Which one is that?
This is Yevamos.
Which one?
Yevamos.
There's brain waves at that point.
Yes. The truth of the matter is modern science kind of correlates, again, around at least approximately that point. There are significant neurological developments that take place, and this was known to the ancient world too, not only in the Gemara. Aristotle mentions 40 days, so the 40 days was a pretty well-established marker that is still has a lot of truth today. But as I say, Rav Moshe Feinstein said that it was not relevant on the abortion issue. But now, let me mention a second line of reasoning, and this hits your point exactly, and that is, okay, let's call it an abortion. But abortion is permitted to save the mother's life. That much we know. So who says it has to be the mother's life? Maybe we have a general position that says if an abortion can save a life, that would be permitted. And stem cell retrieval can certainly save lives. Meaning, instead of saying it's not an abortion, let's call it an abortion and then utilize pikuach nefesh as an exception. So here, in order to understand this argument, there are a few things you have to know. You have to know a machlokas, an argument between Rashi and the Rambam regarding the well-known law. The law is universal. You can abort a fetus to save a mother. That's a given. And even if it's 9 months, nine months, you can do it. But the question is, why is that so? Because after all, you normally cannot kill one person to save another person. So why can you kill fetus to save mother? Machlokes, Rashi, and Rambam. Rashi says the following. Rashi says what I said before. Since the fetus is not really a person, it is only a potential, even though you can't kill a person to save another person, unless it's a rodef, but you can terminate a potential so that an actual life and being can survive, because the actual trumps
the potential. That's Rashi's analytical reasoning. The Rambam, again, this is actually based on a Gemara. The Rambam says differently, and I think many of you may have learned that Gemara. The Rambam says, logically, you shouldn't kill the fetus to save the mother. But if the fetus is the reason why the mother's life is in danger, the fetus is a benign rodef. You're all familiar with rodef? Rodef is simply the rule that says, if I'm chasing after you to kill you, you or even a third party can kill me in self-defense. So Maimonides, again, based on the Gemara, Maimonides didn't invent this. Maimonides basically says that even a fetus who's not yet born, and the fetus is not trying to kill the mother, but if the fetus is the reason for the endangerment, the fetus's life can be forfeited under the principles of Rodef. Now, this is important. This is actually a very important rule, that Rodef does not require a bad, malevolent actor. They tell a story in the Holocaust, perhaps it was apocryphal, I don't know, about a group of Jews were hiding in a bunker, and the Nazis were searching the building, and they had a hidden place, and a baby started crying. And the baby's cries would have given away the whereabouts of the Jews, and the Nazis would have killed all the Jews. So the story goes that the mother tried to keep the baby quiet by putting a blanket over the baby's mouth and nose, and apparently the baby suffocated. That's the awful story. But I want to make the story even more awful. The more awful possibility to consider is, would halacha have permitted the killing of the baby in order to save the 10 people? Because could the argument be made that this baby is endangering the lives of 10 people? This baby, halakhically, therefore, becomes a rodef.
But there's no guarantee that they're going to be saved.
Well, there's no guarantee.
That's
well,
why for life and that's why.
Well, okay, so
it's
so,
a life and unless
they know for a fact.
One second. Remember what the Rambam, look at what the Rambam is saying. Look
it says
what
Kamo rodef, yeah?
He says Kamo rodef.
He says like a
rodef. I understand. But because what he's saying is because there's no intention. But here's the argument I just want to make. If the fetus is treated as Kamo rodef, because although the fetus is not intending to hurt anybody, and this is part of the natural thing that a baby does to come out of the womb, but if as a practical matter it is this fetus that may cause the mother's death, that is enough of a basis to characterize the fetus as Rodef. So I'm just asking you, could a crying baby be characterized the same way? What do you see the difference? No, I understand that. But I'm asking according to the Rambam.
Rambam, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, that's what I would have thought. You feel that it's different according to the...
Yeah, I guess just based on what you were saying, that at that once it's conceived, it's now a life for a life. And
I mean, once it's born, not once it's conceived.
Once it's born. And we talked about this the other day in Madeline's class, that if a bus driver is going towards a group of people, he can't divert.
Okay. So it's important, right, gotcha. So it's important that you see the difference here. You're right. We normally do not play a numbers game. You're 100% correct. In other words, the famous trolley cases, right, the whole branch of moral philosophy, and halakha deals with it very extensively, where I'm driving the trolley and there's five children playing on the track. I won't be able to stop. I'm going to kill five if I just keep on going, but I can divert it to a sidetrack, and there's some old drunk guy that fell asleep on the track, and I'm going to kill one. So you might think, under utilitarian ethics, hey, why don't I just divert and run over one? He shouldn't be sleeping on the track anyway, big drunk guy, and I'll save five. Halacha says you can't. Halacha says you're not allowed to kill one to save five. You're 100% correct. But here, let me point out.
Why?
Huh?
Why?
Because halacha says that we cannot make judgments whose life is more valuable. And even though it looks to us that five kids are, and 100 kids and 1,000 kids, it's amazing, certainly seems to be more valuable than some old drunk who's falling asleep on the track, We don't know. We can't make the judgment. And if you want to express it mathematically, life is an infinity. And infinity cannot be multiplied, so to speak. Meaning to say, a million times infinity is just infinity, right? So you can't say a million lives. Again, this is, okay, but I want to point out two very important differences. Difference number one is, the drunk on the sidetrack is not the cause of the endangerment. The crying baby is endangering that, puts him into the Rodev category. There is another distinction I'll give you as well, which is not relevant to my remarks, and that is, if you don't kill the baby will be killed with the Nazis anyway. Meaning like this. In the case of the drunk, if I keep on going, I'll kill the five kids, but I'm not going to kill him. In the case of the baby is going to die with, in all probability, the baby will die with the group. For example, World Trade Center is a good example. If you have a suicide plane, right, suicide bombers, come to the end of the plane, okay, 200 innocent people on board. They're going to the World Trade Center. If they hit the World Trade Center, whatever number of people died, you know, 2,000 people, 3,000 people died. Are we allowed to shoot down the plane before it reaches the World Trade Center? Now, if all you had were the terrorists on the plane, 1,000%, that is a simple question. They are Roach Finn, and we kill them. But the problem here is, you're killing the 200 innocents on the plane in order to save 3,000 people. You can't make the decision, but many say that you could shoot down the plane. Why? Because those 200 are gonna, again, probably, are gonna die anyway. So it's not saving 3,000 by killing 200. It's saving 3,000 by killing the people who would die as part of that group. Now, the crying baby is very, very similar to that. So I think there are two important distinctions between that and the trolley case that you talked about. One is that the crying baby is the source of the endangerment, and two is the crying baby would probably die along with the Jews who would be captured by the Nazis. Again, you never know for sure. I mean, the Nazis didn't kill everybody, but there was a good chance if they found you hiding, they generally would just shoot you right away. Okay. Now, here's what I want to point out. I want to point out that we have... Yeah?
If regarding the diverting,
yes.
It's just like between your life, if you can either go off the track and kill yourself,
yeah.
Or like kill them.
Yeah, that's an interesting
that's
idea.
That's just only you on the track.
Yes, yes. That's a very interesting position. Maimonides implies that the same way you cannot kill that guy on the track, you can't kill yourself either. In other words, you've got to treat yourself like a life of equal value. You cannot be a martyr in that way. However, many other opinions in the Rishonim, in the medieval commentators, they actually do acknowledge the role of altruistic giving up your life to help others. And of course, we see this all the time with policemen, with soldiers. It's very difficult to understand Maimonides' position because it's very, very clear that people are considered to be very worthy, very righteous, when they're willing to put themselves at risk to help others. So it would seem that the halacha is not like Maimonides in that regard, and you would be allowed to give up your life in order that someone else should not die. But Maimonides would actually be relatively strict on that.
What about the case of water?
Yeah. Again,
in the desert, like water to people.
That passage doesn't prove anything because that passage just says I have the right to keep the water for myself. Mm-hmm. That's Rabbi Akiva's rule. But the question is, but do I have permission to give you the water? I see that would be, Maimonides would say no. Once you have the right to keep the water, you got to save yourself. Others would say you are permitted to give it up. In other words, the Talmud is not discussing sacrificing. The Talmud is discussing when can I keep it? And Rabbi Akiva says I can keep it.
In the case where the mother doesn't have to risk her life in childbirth,
yeah.
she can abort her child.
Yes.
What percent chance is considered risking?
That is a very excellent question because in the real world, you know, you never have something that's 100% risk, or at least 100% that something bad will happen. This is hard to know. It does not have to be 50%. Once you reach something like 20-25%, that is considered to be risky enough that an abortion could be done. I think below that point, not. And again, how you measure this, where do you get these numbers? So here's how you get the numbers. I'll give you a basic calculus. We kind of look at the risks of everyday life. Now, every behavior in everyday life has a certain risk percentage. Driving, going on a bus, walking on the street. So when you're still within the risks that you incur in everyday life, you can't use that as a medical risk to justify abortion. So it has to be significantly higher than the risks that are considered acceptable in everyday life. And that's kind of a general rule. But once you go beyond that, halacha is fairly lenient that even if it's not a very, very high risk, you're permitted to do this. Now, the reason I'm bringing this up is, let's go back to stem cell research. I suggested a line of argument that we could terminate the embryo in order to provide life-saving therapies to someone else. That actually only fits Rashi's paradigm. Because Rashi's paradigm is, you can get rid of a potential, which is exactly what you said, you can get rid of a potential to save an actual, so that would apply. But if you go with Maimonides' paradigm, it actually wouldn't justify it. Because it's one thing to say, if the baby is endangering the mother, the baby is a rodef. But you can't really say, this petri dish here is endangering this Parkinson's patient there. This petri dish is not a rodef. This petri dish is not doing anything that's endangering. You're just taking a life for a life. Now, the Shulchan Aruch, which is the code of Jewish law, when the Shulchan Aruch codifies the heter of killing the fetus to save the mother, the Shulchan Aruch explicitly utilizes Maimonides' construct of kerodef. So as a result, this would not allow the retrieval of stem cell research. So I mentioned two halachic arguments so far, at least very briefly, the pre-40 days, and this idea of pikuach nefesh, and I've shown you that they're questionable at least. Now let me mention a third argument, which actually has been accepted, and this is actually very, very interesting. And that is, if you accept the idea that the fetus is not an actual person, but it's only a potential, and its right to life is based on the protection of its potentiality, so here is the argument. The argument goes that it is not considered potentiality that's deserving of protection, so to speak, until it is in the environment in which, in the normal course of development, it will turn into a human life, meaning the womb. Keep in mind, an embryo in vitro cannot be sustained. You can freeze it, but it's not going to continue to grow beyond a certain point. First of all, the petri dish is small. But besides that, we don't have an artificial womb either. Meaning to say, the maximum amount of development, maybe you could grow it for 2 months. It is not capable of turning into a human life. Now, based on this argument, even if the abortion laws kick in before 40 days, but the argument goes, they cannot kick in until uterine implantation. Until the embryo is in the womb, it is not a potentiality that is capable of becoming a human life. And therefore, this is a whole other heter. This is not the 40 days. This is a pre-implantation versus post-implantation. Now, this has been a heter that many poskim have accepted, and they have allowed retrieval of embryonic stem cell research. But let me mention another area where this comes up a lot. This could legitimate a very important technology called pre-implantation genetic screening. For example, there are certain genetic conditions that certain ethnic groups have more than others, like sickle cell anemia, is associated with blacks, African Americans. So Jews also, particularly Ashkenazic Jews, for whatever reason, have a certain types of disease. Tay-Sachs is the most outstanding example.
What is a
Tay-Sachs is a childhood disease which it's kind of almost like a childhood Lou Gehrig's disease, where a child gradually loses all sorts of muscle function and loses eyesight and loses hearing, and there is no cure at all so far, and the children do suffer a lot, and they die typically before 6, 7, 8, that age. Very, very awful, sad disease. In order for a kid to have Tay-Sachs, both parents must carry the gene. And if both parents carry the gene, there's a 1 in 4 chance that a kid will be affected. But if only one parent has the gene, there is no chance any kid will be sick, but there is a 1 in 4 that a kid may be a carrier for the next generation and the like. Now, they have within the Jewish community, it was started in the Orthodox community, various premarital screening programs where people can be screened. So if your girlfriend is a carrier and you're a carrier, you'll know that it's better for you not to get married. But not everybody uses these screening programs, and sometimes they find out afterwards. So here I just want to go through a quick laundry list. If chas v'shalom, two people are married, and they discover they are both carriers of the Tay-Sachs gene, so there's a 1 in 4 chance they will have a Tay-Sachs child that will have an awful death. So what are the options? What are they supposed to do at that point? So I'm going to go through just a list of things, and we can kind of rate them. Is that sensible? Is it good? Is it kosher? Is it right? Option number one is they can get divorced and just marry somebody else. That is an option. But once again, Judaism recognizes that if they love each other, you know, we're not going to tell them get divorced. You can't just tell a person marry somebody else. People are not interchangeable in that way. And for halacha to compel a divorce when there was no sin in their marriage, we're not talking. If there's a sinful marriage, like an intermarriage, sometimes there's no choice. Indeed, the halacha says get divorced. But here, there are other options. Okay, option two is permanent contraception. Let's have a marriage without kids, or we'll adopt or something. Well, that's a big problem. The very first mitzvah in the Torah is to be fruitful and multiply. So sometimes people don't have children if it's beyond their control, but we don't really allow halachically to say get married and specifically intend not to have kids. So option two is not a good option either. Option three, let's go ahead and try to have kids, and whenever there's a pregnancy, we'll do an amniocentesis to see if it's a Tay-Sachs baby. It's only be 1 in 4, and we'll just abort it. Well, once again, big, big problem. Generally speaking, abortion, as we said, is only forbidden if the mother, I'm sorry, is only permitted if the mother's life is in danger. You cannot abort for genetic abnormalities. Now, again, as I indicated, if the information is so traumatizing to the mother that she's suicidal, that may be a case. But as a general rule, you do not abort children because of genetic abnormalities. And that's why Rabbi Feinstein was not even in favor of amniocentesis, because what is the use of this type of testing if you can't... Now, if it's something that can be corrected through surgery, then yes, there's a useful need to have that information. But if the only basis, the only thing you'll do with the information is abort, and you're not allowed to abort, better not to know. Then maybe God does miracles or other things. Yeah.
Don't we treat suffering as sickness in and of itself? So if a child would get born and do nothing but suffer his whole entire life, and the only way to treat the child by killing him, we know he's not going to live a life anyways. Is that against halacha?
Well, it is. It is. It is against halacha because, again, why God puts the soul into this earth is really beyond us, and sometimes the soul needs that experience. I do want to point out too that parents of Tay-Sachs children, when people sometimes insensitively remarked after their child's death, "Wouldn't it be better if he would never have been born?" The parents do not see it that way. They will identify moments of joy and moments of love and moments of closeness. Again, it's hard for us to understand, and I sound callous if I even talk about it that way, but that is genuinely how it is described. You're not talking about a life devoid of meaning. It's a hard life, but it's a life in which, you know, there was connection.
So if it's not devoid of meaning, then the only option you have is to let the kid live. If there's some godless reason why the kid has to come back,
that's,
you have a choice in the first place to do anything else.
That's correct. So I mentioned three things. I mentioned divorce, not so good. Permanent contraception, not so good. Selective abortion, not so good. But there is a fourth option that, at least as a matter of technical halacha, but maybe not philosophically, could actually possibly work. That is, that all pregnancies should be attempted through in vitro fertilization, meaning when they have coitus, marital relationships, they can use a condom or whatever it is, and then they would attempt pregnancies through an in vitro, and then they could do pre-implantation genetic screening for the Tay-Sachs and the like, and based on the rule that the abortion laws don't kick in until implantation, that type of abortion would actually be halachically justified by analogy to the retrieval of stem cells and the like. Now, that is a technical out, so to speak, but I think that brings us to the last choice, and that is the true emuna, the highest level of faith, is to basically say that I will take what God gives me and I will make the best of it, and I will assume that it's a blessing, and I will endeavor to make it a blessing. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you go ahead and do, and, you know, maybe God will have mercy on you, because not everybody's, you know, one out of four doesn't mean you have to be the one out of four, meaning statistics don't apply in every individual case that way. Although this is certainly the derech of the righteous, this is the way of the righteous, but halacha recognizes that not everybody is capable at every stage of their life of living by that level, and therefore there are what you might call loopholes that would justify certain aggressive procedures, and pre-implantation genetic screening might be such a loophole that would be justified, because it doesn't run afoul of the technical abortion laws.
When does you mentioned like 40 days and stuff? I was wondering, when does the soul enter the?
Here's the thing. You're 100% correct. You would think that would be a very relevant question. Yeah. It seems that the there is a soul in utero. Because the angel is teaching in the uterus, because the angel is teaching the baby Torah, but that seems to be halachically an appendage of the mother's soul. He doesn't have his own independent soul until he's born.
Okay.
Yep, that's the Jewish position, and that is why abortion is not murder, because the independent godly soul does not enter the fetus, the person, until he is born. That's why killing the embryo is not murder. That's exactly the reason. In fact, I should tell you, there's even a view in the Talmud that a boy does not get a soul until his circumcision. But that doesn't mean you can kill him before 8 days. But, you know, the soul may come pretty late in the process. You know, it may even come after birth.
So the soul, like David died, you know, 10, 20 years ago, and then was reincarnated into this new embryo.
Yeah,
it's part of the mother's soul, like they're intertwined until he's born.
That's correct. Okay. They are intertwined. In other words, it's potentially going to be a new entity, but it's so at this point it's connected. It's connected.
How does a body come out without a soul? How did they cry? How did they have emotion?
So the answer would be, you have to understand, this is a complicated thing. The soul is a multifaceted entity, and there is an aspect of the soul that is the animal or biological soul, but that doesn't yet confer human status. So obviously the baby has the physiological soul that's doing digestion and breathing, mm-hmm. and everything else. But what makes it human and Jewish is the godly soul. and the godly soul is a different aspect of existence. Now, whether that's two souls, whether it's an enhanced capacity of a single soul, that's a whole other question. But there are multiple levels of the soul, and they come in at different stages in development and the like. So this is just like one example of how halacha approaches a complex technology. And it does remind all of us that in order to apply halacha to any area, there are two things you have to know. You have to know the halacha, and you have to know the facts on the ground. You know, if you're a rabbi and you know the whole Talmud and you know everything, but you don't really understand the technology, it's going to be garbage in, garbage out, because the psak halacha will only be as valid as the factual knowledge that are being applied to it. So that is why when a rav has to rule on these matters, he needs to be in touch with physicians and researchers to be sure that he fully understands the science and the technology. And this is sometimes a matter of life and death. You know, to take another area, you know, when we talk about life support and how do you treat people, and you know, the rav has to know exactly what these processes are. Some of them might be murder if you discontinue them, and sometimes some of them might be permitted. And you know, without knowing exactly what's going on, you might either be guilty of murder or the other way, prolonging somebody's suffering, which should not have been prolonged. So there needs to be a strong collaboration with scientists, with psychologists, with therapists, with mental health, and together we can apply the will of Hashem in any given circumstance. Okay, wish you all a happy Hanukkah, and we'll see you later. Okay.